couple of decades ago, a teaching became very, very popular and was accepted by most in our society, in fact, most around the world today, and that's the teaching of the necessity of having a healthy, quote-unquote, self-esteem. It was suggested, in fact, beyond suggestion, it was stated that man is of great value to collectively and individually. You are just a very important person. You have great potential. You are worthy of just about everything. In fact, might as well not even say just about. You are worthy of everything. And if you set your mind to it, if you realize how wonderful you are, you can do just about anything. In fact, you take over the world. We bought that hook, line, and sinker. And I would like to suggest to you that many of the problems that we are facing, behavioral problems of people in the world today, can be traced back to the idea that they believe they are good, worthy individuals. There's no longer any right or wrong. I'm just worthy of whatever I desire. I've got a great self-esteem. The teaching of self-esteem actually is not a new concept. Now, the term may be, but the concept literally goes back to the very beginning of time. When Adam and Eve were in the garden and Satan came around and he said to them, "Has God said, can't you eat of everything in the garden here?" And there was a little discussion going on. And in the end of it, Satan said to Eve, "Well, you're really worthy of it. If you would take of this forbidden fruit, you would become as gods. You would reach your full potential. You could take over the world. You just need a healthy self-esteem." And we kind of know what problems that brought about with it. Sin enters into the world and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for all have sinned. But it has been Satan's lie throughout the ages that if man would just think of himself as good, as great, as powerful, he can do whatever he wants to do, even take over the world. In fact, in the end of time, there is going to be a man who will be the consummate man of self-esteem. He will be the one who realizes his full potential. He will be a charismatic and personality fellow. He will be winsome. He will be energetic. He will be a great leader. In fact, we're going to look at that next week. He is called biblically the Antichrist. But that's for next week. This morning, we want to look at a precursor or a foreshadower of the Antichrist. It was a Greek ruler by the name of Antiochus IV, commonly known as Antiochus Epiphanes. And I would have you to turn in your Bibles with me this morning to Daniel chapter 11 to read the account of this ancient Greek ruler, lived about 2,000 plus years ago, about 2,100 years ago, actually. Verse 21 begins his description. Remember, this is a prophecy that was being given to Daniel by, I believe, God himself. Last week we looked at the first 20 verses of the different kings of the Grecian Empire which would come and how they were constantly battling one with the other. And now we get down towards the end of the Grecian Empire. Verse 21 says, "And in his estate..." Now, his estate there, remember, there were two prominent families, the Seleucid families to the north and the Ptolemies to the south. And the estate here would be of the Seleucid families in the north. "And in his estate shall stand up a vile person." The word vile is an interesting Hebrew word. It is generally translated in the Old Testament as contemptible. The root of the word has the idea of meaning something with little or no value to it, meaningless. And in the estimation of God, this man had little or no value. Little or no value to humanity, although he is going to be a very domineering person. He will literally go to conquer the world. He will Well, in fact, in his own eyes, when he became the king, he took a title to himself. He was known as Antiochus the Fourth, but the title that he gave himself was Antiochus IV Theos Epiphanes. Antiochus the Fourth, the manifestation of God. If you want to look at what God is like, basically, he was saying, look at me. I am the consummate man. I have reached my full potential. I am the manifestation of God. No lack of self-esteem there. But in the eyes of God, he was a vile, contemptible, worthless fellow. And in the eyes of those that were around him, he was called Antiochus Epimenes, Antiochus the madman. They thought he had flipped his lid, gone off the deep end, was nuts, and they were right. Now notice what it says about him. In his estate, that is the estate of Seleucus, and Seleucus the fourth was the king in verse 20, who was poisoned. In his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. When Seleucus the Fourth died, the rightful heir to the throne was one of his two sons. But there was a problem with both of them. His oldest son, a man by the name of Demetrius, was being held captive by the Romans. And obviously the Romans were not going to say, oh, look, your father died, there's a kingdom out there that you should go back and take the throne and rule, which happens to be an enemy of us. We're just going to let you go to do that. Obviously, they were not going to do that. So Demetrius could not take the throne. The younger of the two boys was a man by the name of Antiochus also. But I made a mistake. He wasn't a man. He was a little infant. And obviously, you could not have a little baby sitting on the throne to rule the people. So there was a void in the kingdom of the northern kingdom of Greece, the Syrian kingdom. There was no one to sit on the throne. Now, Antiochus was the fourth, and Epiphanes was the brother to Seleucus. He was over in Athens, and word came to him that there was nobody to sit on the throne, and he realized, I have a great opportunity lying in front of me to go back there and be king. There's just one little problem. I'm not the rightful heir. How am I going to get the throne? And it says here in verse 21, he came in peaceably and obtained the kingdom by flatteries. The Hebrew word that's translated flatteries is a word whose root literally means to be slippery. In other words, he's coming in with promises that are slippery. He's going to offer one thing, and when you go to grasp it, it's going to leave you. He's going to make promises that he had no intentions of fulfilling. He would come in and he would say to the people of the kingdom, look, you got a problem here. It's a sad, sad thing that we don't have a leader right now. But I'll tell you what, I think I can help out. I'll tell you what, I'll take the throne for a little while. Maybe we can free up Demetrius and he can come back and he can take the throne. And if we can't free him up, well, then I'll just hold the throne down till Antiochus grows up and he's old enough and he's groomed and he's ready. Then I'll step aside. I'll do you a favor. I'll just take it temporarily. And the people thought, well, that sounds pretty good. And by his slipperiness, he took the kingdom peacefully. You know, Satan likes to do that with us. There comes a time in our lives where there's a little void. Maybe it's the loss of a loved one. Maybe it's the loss of a job. Maybe it's the loss of finances. Maybe it's the loss of importance, a loss of significance. And you're wondering, how am I going to fill this void in my life? Satan knocks on the door of your heart and says, listen, I know that the Lord is the ruler of your life, but you've got this emptiness here, and there doesn't seem anything to be able to fill it right now. I'll tell you what, why don't I sit on the throne until something else comes along? I'm not asking you to get rid of the Lord. I realize you have a need right now. I can fill that need for you. I won't stay around long. I just want to help you out in your time of need. And he puts his foot inside the door of our heart for just a moment. But he never goes away. That was never Antiochus Epiphanes' intent. His intent was to take not only the kingdom of Syria, but the entire world. Notice the consequences down here in verse 22. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. He comes in and he says, I'm just going to stay here. I'm going to just maintain things, not going to do anything drastic. And as soon as they allow him to rule, he takes control of everything. The people are subjugated to him. They are overflown like a flood. They perish. They're broken before him. Not only the people of Syria, but he had his intent set on Egypt too. And remember last week there was a map behind me on the screen here, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, and they were constantly fighting each other. And what nation was in between? Israel. And consequently, as he's coming on down to Egypt to get rid of the Egyptians and take over the world, he was going to be overflowing the Israelites. In fact, it says in the end of verse 22, even the prince of the covenant, which was a reference to the high priest in Israel. Remember, God had made a covenant with Abraham and the people of Israel that he would give them a land and various different things. There was the Davidic covenant where there would always be a king to sit on the throne. Various covenants that God had instituted with the nation of Israel. And those things were kept by the king of Israel. But since the Babylonians came and defeated Israel, there was no king sitting on the throne. And it kind of came to the high priest to take over the guardianship of the covenant, to keep the people in a right relationship with their God. There was a man at the time, his name was Onias III, apparently a very godly man. And Antiochus Epiphanes did not like him. And as he was overflowing, he came to Jerusalem, and he ousted Onias from the high priest and put his brother Jason in as the high priest. He would say, well, two guys are brothers. Probably they're going to be similar. Jason wanted to bring Greek culture into the life of the Israelites. It's a very subtle thing here. Now, he didn't want to get rid of God, didn't want to get rid of the worship of God. But how that translated over into everyday living, that's what he wanted to change. We don't want to do things the way we've always done them, the way God instructed. We have a whole new way. Look, these Greeks, they're pretty sophisticated people. They've got Plato and Socrates. That was a little joke there. And all those famous philosophers, the guys that went around asking questions that nobody had answers to and made them sound so significant and so smart and so intelligent. And the question is, if no one had answers to them, why would they even bother asking the questions? Nonetheless, Jason wanted to bring that type of lifestyle into the Hebrew world, and it could coexist with the worship of Jehovah. That's bad news. That's real bad news, because God had called these people to live after His holy commandments. Satan tries to come in, get that foot in the door. Oh, I'll only be here a moment. But once he gets in the door, everything goes to pieces. those things that He gets you doing to fulfill that void that's in your life become addictions. And consequently, lifestyles are changed. Then the next thing, verse 23. Now he's gone down, he's subjugated to the Egyptians somewhat. Verse 23 says, and after the league made, he went down, he had some conquest in Egypt, and he said to the Egyptians, you know what? We don't need to be fighting each other all the time. Let's make a pact of peace between us. After the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches. Yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. What happens here is now that he's gotten himself squared away in his ruling of Syria, he wants to come up against the king of Egypt and overtake Egypt because Syria was not enough for him. And he says, you know what, we need to make a pact. Here we are, we're brothers under the skin. We're Greeks. We have the same background. In fact, they literally were related to one another. Why should we be fighting one against the other when the Romans are out there and that's a common enemy? We need to make this pact. We need to fight them and let's be buddy buddies. And they said, okay, that sounds like a legitimate thing to do. And one day after they made the pact, Antiochus Epiphanes gets a little group of people together and starts marching on down to Egypt. Just a little group of people. Didn't look like an army or anything. It looked like here's the king bringing an embassy with them. They're coming down to visit with us and fellowship with us and make strategy against our common enemy. And let's put our defenses down. Let's let these people in. They're our brothers under the skin. And before they knew it, they were conquered. They would spoil a little city here. But Antiochus was going to do something that was never done before, according to verse 24. He would take the spoils of the war and he would buy the people for himself. Instead of the king getting all the glory, all the riches, and using it on himself in any perverted way that he wanted to, it was like Robin Hood taking from the rich and giving back to the poor and making the poor his buddies. He said, see, I'm really a good king after all. I don't want to destroy you. I want you to join with me. And they'd get a few more people and they would go on to the next little town. And the people would think, well, here comes Antiochus and it's just a small group of people with them. And hey, look, some of our folks are with them. They must be coming in peace. And they'd let their defenses down and he'd come in, destroy them, and buy those people up. And before you know it, he had a pretty good-sized army that he was coming against the king of the south. Well, the king of the south realized, hey, this isn't working out too well. He got a big army together. His name was Ptolemy the Sixth. And they went to war, and Ptolemy was captured. The way in which he was captured, according to verse 26, a couple of his generals forsook him. They committed treason. They gave him over to Antiochus. They said, here's a guy that I don't think we can stop him. Let's give our king over and we'll have peace. So Ptolemy the Sixth was captured. According to verse 27, these two kings decided that they were going to sit down again at another peace table. And the one said, Antiochus said to Ptolemy, look, if you help me, we're going to capture all of Egypt, and I'll put you back in charge under my rule. Ptolemy wanted to get back his country. And he said to Antiochus, okay, I'll do that. You put me in charge. But what he was really thinking is, you get back my country, and I'm coming against you, buddy. They were using each other. Willing to work together, supposedly for a common cause, but fighting each other. And it says here in verse 27, it shall not prosper, for God hadn't appointed it to be so. They came down against the city of Memphis, which is in the northern part of, very northern part of Egypt. They won that. They went down against Alexandria, were defeated there. Consequently, Ptolemy the VI became the mayor, if you would, or the leader of Memphis. But Ptolemy the VII, his brother, had the rest of the kingdom. Interesting way things are going on. Now look at verse 28. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Here they are, they're fighting these battles. They get down into Alexandria, they're defeated there. And word comes from back in Jerusalem. You see, right before they went down upon these battles, remember Jason, the high priest who was put in there by Antiochus? He got thrown out of his job. A man by the name of Menelaus was put in there. You see, Satan wasn't interested in just having Greek culture in Jerusalem. He wanted to wipe out all aspects of the worship of God. And Menelaus was the man to do it. Jason had heard a rumor that Antiochus was killed in battle. And wanting his job back, he started fighting against Menelaus. Here comes Antiochus back after being defeated. He sees what's going on. He gets angry that his man that he put in there is being attacked. He brings all his forces against the Jews, squashes the rebellion, and takes the precious things from out of the tabernacle back to Syria with him. In fact, by this time, it's the temple. Satan gets a foothold in the door, promises he's only going to be there for a short period of time, brings in this idea of, look, we don't need to be fighting each other. We've got common opponents out there. We see this in the church today. Let's break down the barriers between denominations, between isms and arnums. After all, we're all Christians, aren't we? And we've got common enemies out there. Let's band together against abortion. Let's band together against pornography. Let's band together against this. And we're going to march, and we're going to picket, and we're going to influence, and we're going to vote. And all those things are good things. But they're not the best things. For you see, to defeat those things, the best way is to lead people to Christ. The Christian isn't going to want any parts of pornography, of abortion, of homosexual lifestyle and all those things. But we're not interested in converting people to Christ. There's too many differences amongst us. And what happens when we surrender the uniqueness of faith is that Satan comes back and steals the most precious things from our lives. Antiochus goes back up into Syria, verse 29, at the time appointed he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former as the latter, as he did twice before. He gets upset, he's gathering together an army, and it's a massive army, and he comes down against Egypt. But this time, verse 30, the ships of Chittim, which is a reference to Rome, shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation. Now what happens is he comes down to fight Egypt, but by this time the Roman Empire has really gained in strength, and they're about ready to wipe the Greeks out. And a man by the name of Gaius Papilius Laenas, an officer in the Roman army, comes down at Alexandria, and stops Antiochus dead in his tracks and says, you will either go back to Syria and mind your own business, or you're going to face us. Antiochus thought he could play the stalling game. Well, I don't know what. Give me some time to think about it. Basically, he was hoping that Lannis would just back off and he would take his opportunity and conquer the area, and by that time, everything would be fine. Lannis literally drew a circle around where Antiochus was standing and said, before you step out of this circle, you will give us an answer whether you're going back to Syria or you're fighting us. And Antiochus dropped his head and headed on back to Syria because he knew he couldn't defeat the Romans. He thought he could look impressive. He thought he could just roll in there and tell everybody he was irresistible, he was undefeatable. But there was a greater power than him. On the way back, he gets angry. He shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. That would be the people of Israel. So shall he do. He shall even return and have allegiance with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. Yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. Now on the way back, Antiochus is really mad. He's been frustrated and he's going to let out his anger amongst the Jews. There were a number of Jews that sided with him against the covenant that they had with God. He's actually aided Antiochus in what he was going to do. Now remember, it started out, just going to hold things down here, nothing drastic. Listen what he ended up doing. The daily sacrifice, no more of them. Can't have daily sacrifices. The temple courts that were used for praise, the Roman soldiers, along with harlots, practiced harlotry in this house of God. The altar of sacrifice, where the clean animals were supposed to be sacrificed, they sacrificed pigs. They required the Jews to participate in a festival to the god Bacchus, which is the god of wine. And the festival necessitated becoming drunk and let everything go out the window. Circumcision was outlawed, which was the sign of the covenant between God and the people. You could have no relationship, no outward relationship with the God who brought you to this place. The feast days, you couldn't celebrate them, which talked about in type what God was doing for the people and bringing salvation to them. The Old Testament was declared to be unlawful, and any copy of it that was found was to be burned. And just in case you had any other vestiges of worship of Jehovah, the temple was rededicated and an image of Zeus was put in it. I don't want any mention of God whatsoever in the lives of these people. But along comes a man by the name of Judas Maccabeus. And he said, we will not stand for this. He raised up some people to go with him. They, according to verse 32, they that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. They shall come against Antiochus and his people. But it's going to be a rough battle. Many of them were going to die. many of them would be suffering. Oh, there would be some people when the Maccabeans would come along and they would win a skirmish here and a skirmish here. Some of the Jews would say, you know what, maybe we better get on the right side. We're really not committed to these folks, but they seem to be winning. So we'll stay with them for a little while. But then some of the Maccabeans would die and those that were there faded away. And according to verse 35, this shall continue until the tribulation period. Now the question is asked, is it worth it? Should I fight for the things of God or just go with the flow of time, the ways of the world? After all, this is going to be a long battle. Don't I deserve better than this? Aren't I worth it? Isaac Watts put it this way: must I be carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease, while others fought to win the prize and sailed through bloody seas? Are there no foes for me to face? Must I not stem the flood? Is this vile world a friend of grace to help me on to God? Sure, I must fight if I would reign. Increase my courage, Lord. I'll bear the toil, endure the pain, supported by thy word. This may have happened historically 2,100 years ago, but it's still happening every day today. We are faced daily with the one who would go about seeking whom he can devour. With a little knock on the door of our hearts, just let me in, I'll fill that void for just a short period of time. We don't want to get God out of your life. You've got a void here, let me help. Will you fight? Will you let them in? And if you let them in, it's just a matter of time till all the things precious are gone. And then even he'll want to destroy the very knowledge of God in you. Is it worth the fight? Well, we'll have to go to the end to find out. But I think you know the answer to that question. Who wins? Not the Antiochuses. Not the Antichrist. You see, there was a power greater than Antiochus. It was the Roman army. And eventually, Greece came to an end. But there's a greater power than the Roman army. For even the devil himself, he's called God. And he's the one who will ultimately rule. Will you fight or will you let it go to waste? Let's pray. Father, we're engaged in a battle. Increase our courage. Lord, may when Satan comes seeking to take our heart by flattery, may we be strong to resist him, to kick him out, to keep him from entering, to fight, the good fight of faith, to be more than conquerors through him who loved us. And Lord, I know it'll be a difficult task. The war will be long. It will last the rest of our lives. But I'm thankful this morning that I also know who wins. Lord, increase our faith that we might stand with you in victory, fighting day in and day out for the things that are precious to us, our relationship with you, our fellowship with you, our service for you. And use us, Lord, to reach the world with the gospel of peace. Father, I thank you for the victory that's found in Jesus Christ. May we all partake of it today. In his name we pray. Amen.